You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Monday morning. I got a weather update from Montana. Warm, windy, and smoky. Yep, that's the way they do it up there in the summer. Joining me from a place that's a little warmer and a lot more humid, Tampa, Florida, is Jarvis Lynch, Major General, United States Marine Corps, retired. Sir, good morning. How are you?
Just fine, Mac, and you?
I'm all right. So tell us about, about what, 10 months out of the year, Tampa's a beautiful place?
Oh, yeah. It is. In the summer, it gets a little too hot and too humid for comfort, but you gotta live with it. You don't have snow, so there's a compromise there. I don't have to shovel snow in the wintertime.
Well, wait a minute. You grew up in New Jersey, right? You're not like a snow guy. It's not like you're from Minnesota or something like that.
Oh, no. No, that's true. But I thought when I was a kid that New Jersey was the humidity capital of the world.
So you moved to someplace with less humidity like Tampa.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, well, you know, I went from Paris Island to Tampa, and I thought Paris Island was, I had a drill instructor told me one time that he had found the hottest place on Earth, and it was Paris Island, and I had to agree with him. I thought it was in the middle of summer, but it wasn't. I was wrong.
The Tampa hotter than Paris Island?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It sure is.
I think Kuwait has them both beat, though.
I'm sure you're right. And we just took a trip to the Southwest. Well, it's been a couple of weeks now since we've been home, but the temperatures out there at the time were approaching 120, and that put it in a class with Vietnam.
Where'd you go? Where was it? 120? Were you in Phoenix?
They had a real hot spell.
You know, maybe it's you just steering the heat of the planet wherever you go.
Probably, yeah. I like to think things like that.
Well, look, if you head towards Southern California, give me a heads up so I can make sure that my air conditioner is working.
I'll do that. But I don't care for California, so I don't expect to be there for
all right. Well, that's good. That's good for those of us who live here then. What I want to have you on, because very much by chance, I was having a conversation with a company commander from Quezon, and he asked me if I knew anything about My Lai. And I said, well, you know, a little bit, but not much. And then after I got off the phone, I had one of those epiphanies where I said to myself, how do you not know anything about that? You know, anything of substance about it. Don't you think you should? And I answered myself and said, yeah. So I started watching interviews with Vietnam with veterans of, Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment of the United States Army. And that was the company that Ernest Medina commanded, guys from the platoon that William Calley led. And so I got to, you know, kind of talking about it. And I played some of the audio here, and it's really astounding. And then it got me to thinking of the environment that those guys led in. The first time we go to war is an integrated American military that we have blacks in mixed in with whites. The racial issue isn't decided yet in the country in terms of how it all works together. Does it really live up to the Constitution? You know, kids grew up in Jim Crow parts of the country. from Boston to, you know, to the Deep South. And so I wanted to have you on to talk about, one, get your thoughts on MeLive, because it's an insurgency, certainly, but there's also a conventional war going on, and you guys move in and out of that. And but in the mind's eye of the young guys who fought it, you know, we haven't done an insurgency yet. Now, I come in the Marine Corps after Vietnam, and so I'm constantly raised with the difference between fighting insurgencies like we fought in Vietnam, and then also, you know, World War II, Korea, more conventional operations. So I grew up with them. You know, the military as it grew up post-World War II didn't grow up with insurgencies. There may have been some guys that were involved in them, but there weren't too many. So I wanted to have you on to talk about what it was like to lead in that era, and also to get your thoughts on MeLive. So can we start with the leadership environment, sir? And was it different? Is too much made of that? What was it like to lead in the 60s in Vietnam?
Good question. I think I better cut it down to insurgency and conventional warfare for a start.
Okay.
In the 60s in Vietnam, no, I will back off. We started training for counterinsurgency counter-guerrilla, we call it in those days, warfare in the late 50s. At least we did in the 4th Marine Regiment, which was then located in Hawaii, at Kaneohe Bay, mm-hmm. part of the 1st Marine Brigade.
Right.
We had within that regiment, fortuitously, including the regimental commander, and this may have been why we started it there, at least, we had officers who had served behind the Japanese lines in China, and they were leading guerrilla forces. One of them was not in the 4th Marines, but the most famous of them all was General Barrow, right. Who became commandant.
Right.
But we had the regimental commander was Colonel John Masters, who retired as a major general. Wonderful man. We had the battalion commander of the 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, Milton Hull. Bear Mat 6 was their call sign, and he was a Bear Mat, no question about it. He lived up with it. And there were a few others. But nonetheless, we started training at counter-guerrillas, but the training exercises, inevitably, I thought at the time, transformed themselves from counter-guerrilla to conventional warfare. I was an aggressor at the largest counter-guerrilla or counter-insurgency exercise conducted before the Vietnam commitment, and that was Exercise Silver Lance, conducted at Camp Pendleton by the 1st Marine Division, by Fleet Marine Force Pacific. General Kulak, then the commanding general of Fleet Marine Force Pacific, was there observing that exercise. But that, too, it started out, my company, I was from the Infantry Training Regiment, 2nd ITR, and I was appointed as a company commander, and I was given a company that was about ready to graduate from ITR. We actually trained as villagers. And we had a village on San Clemente Island. But that part of the exercise was scrubbed because one morning, the 1st Marine Brigade, or the 4th Marine Regiment, rather, was supposed to come back for that exercise and was responsible for San Clemente Island and defeating the guerrillas, defeating us. they woke up one morning and found out they were about to get aboard ship and steam westward, which is what they did.
Right.
So that part was canceled, and we actually became a conventional. We were called guerrillas, but it was a conventional training exercise. But there was a lot in schools. There was much said about it. And in those days, I vividly recall thinking, we're not going to have a nuclear war. And we're not going to have a big conventional war that could lead to nuclear war. Then the only thing we're going to have is proxy wars, which will be the counterinsurgency nature. And so, therefore, there was a lot written about it, and a lot talked about it, and a lot thought about it. Then in 1968, I go to Vietnam, and...
Okay, so let me stop you. So,
yeah, okay.
So the years that you're talking about relative to training are 66, 67?
Yeah, well, yes. Silver Lance was 65. And after that, the division, 1st Marine Division left Camp Pendleton. There was nobody there except the ITR and base functions.
So we had had our initial experiences, 63 to 65, and then during that time, those lessons learned are coming back, to Headquarters Marine Corps, and now we're beginning to modify training and get into a mindset. So when you went to Vietnam, you were very much in the mindset of the guerrilla warfare. I mean, I remember the Asianville was still at the basic school when I went through it in 1984, and which was built in the 60s by guys who had come back and said, you guys got to learn how to do this stuff, and they built an Asian village at the basic school. So in retrospect, do you think you were well prepared prior to hitting Vietnam relative to what an insurgency was and how to deal with it?
Probably as well prepared as I could have been.
Right.
And most of the preparation was mental, and it was from reading or from talking with people. And a make-mac is that when I got to Vietnam, there was not the classic guerrilla warfare that everybody was talking about. What there was a combination of the two. I went to the 3rd Marine Division. That was not guerrilla warfare up there. That was conventional warfare. 3rd Marine Division versus the North Vietnamese Army is what it amounted to. And or whatever part of the North Vietnamese Army that tried to get into the 3rd Marine Division's area. When we went further south, we encountered, we were made a battalion landing team. We became a 7th Fleet asset. We were used numerous places along the coast. Having started with the 3rd Marine Division, we left a couple of months later, 1st Marine Division for a while, partly counter-guerrilla, partly conventional, then down to the AmeriCal Division area of operations. And we actually operated for a period of time near a place called My Lai, which while we were there, we never heard anything about. I didn't know anything about My Lai until after my tour of duty ended. I was stationed in Washington, D.C., and one morning the Washington Post broke this horrible story of My Lai, which I'd never known about. And I looked at on the paper, on the map, and by God, I'd been there. Not the village itself, but I'd been around there, as had our battalion. And that was basically, that part of it was counter-guerrilla, although we had very little contact with any Vietnamese villagers or any Vietnamese people.
I'm curious about what part of the year did you go there? What month in 1968?
To My Lai area?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that was 69. That,
okay.
That's still
right. The
following
year.
Got it.
Okay. So I'm curious about your preparation to go to Vietnam. and the law of land warfare stuff that you studied, because one of the things that I found in talking to Vietnam veterans about My Lai, and one of the things it's been pretty interesting, sir, is that they want to talk about it. I wasn't sure initially. How their reaction would be. They want to talk about it, and they get very emotional about it because it colors people's service in Vietnam, and
yes.
and so they're very, most are very bitter about it, and they also say that people don't understand what kind of war that war was. So I'm curious, the law of land warfare as you knew it, as you went to Vietnam, what was a village that was VC sympathizers? Those are civilians. So how did you look at it? Did you get taught anything about it, or was it simply OJT?
I think it was largely on-the-job training. There were rules of engagement, for example, in those days. We knew there were rules of engagement. We didn't know what the hell they were, but we knew there were rules of engagement. And you would go from one area to another, and there'd be different sets of rules of engagement. Everywhere we went, we thought about rules of engagement, and we didn't know what the hell they were, and quite frankly, didn't care what they were. The point was, we knew what was decency and what is not. We knew what is taking casualties unnecessarily and what is not. I didn't think that much about those kinds of things. And as far as what I thought about My Lai, after I came back from Vietnam, I was at headquarters Marine Corps, and sometime in, I think it was 1970, I was ordered to go to the old executive office building in Washington to be interviewed by an Army Brigadier General to be the aide, naval aide to the Vice President of the United States, Spiro Agnew. So I went there the next morning. I was told one day, the next morning, I'm biffed up, and off I go to the old executive office building, which I even found, and got in there, and a very fine gentleman, this Army Brigadier, the first thing he asked me was, stated, you are a volunteer. And I said, if I am selected for this position, sir, I will do the very best I possibly can. And he said, you are not a volunteer. No, I said, no, sir, I'm not a volunteer. At headquarters Marine Corps, they told me, they're asking for volunteers, but we're sending who we want to send. See, right. So, and he said, he used that expression, a GD Marines. He said, we asked for volunteers, we've interviewed a half a dozen of you people, we haven't found a volunteer yet. And I just told him, I don't think you will. Headquarters Marine Corps is not going to send any. Headquarters Marine Corps will send who they want to send. So in any event, he and I had, I thought, a very nice rapport, and we did. And then he was asking me, trying to get my attitude on war and all that kind of thing. He said, what do you think of My Lai? And I said, sir, undisciplined rabble. And he looked at me, he said, undisciplined rabble. I said, yes, sir. That's what you think. Yes, sir. Well, Major, thank you very much for coming over. We've had a nice chat, this, that, and the other. And I was sent back to headquarters. And, you know, my boss the next morning said, that afternoon when he saw me, said, well, how'd it go? I said, it went all right, sir. I'm not going to get that job, but I'm not worried about it. The sun will come up tomorrow. And he said, why aren't you going to get the job? I said, he asked me what I thought about My Lai. He said, what'd you tell him? I said, I told him undisciplined rabble. He's a good colonel. He retired Major General Calhoun Killeen. He's gone now. But he looked at me and said, why the hell did you tell him what you really think? in any case, that's what I thought. That's what I've always thought. And you didn't need to have big-time training in counter-guerrilla warfare in villages to know that that kind of thing was wrong. you don't need it. It was wrong in World War II. Why the hell wouldn't it be wrong now? Which, obviously, a way of looking at it. But nonetheless, the thing you had to watch as a leader was the troops getting, and their leadership, officer, captain, lieutenant leadership, getting intensely annoyed to the part of looking for revenge if something went wrong around one of those villages. Example, what do they call them? Booby traps.
Right.
But the government called them surprise firing devices. We call them booby traps. But in any case, you had to be watchful for that, for the revenge aspect. Because he wouldn't think, he'd stop thinking for a minute. I saw a Marine trip one day. He was careless. He was walking along the top of a berm, and he hit a trip bar. Boom! The thing went off. I just happened to be looking at him at the time. But the thing was, the device was, the explosion didn't kill him. Didn't even wound him. It was the trip wire was across the path or the trail at the top of the berm. The device itself was about 15, 20 yards down the berm. Somebody had been ordered to set a booby trap. They went out and did it, but they set it in a fashion that it wouldn't hurt anybody. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, an offset.
You had that kind of thing. And there were, if you got a VC, finding VC when I was there was not an easy problem.
Right.
The further south you went, the more Viet Cong type thing you ran into. But even if you found, so what? You shake the village down, you get a couple of, first place you got a male in the village, and the guy's 20 years old, somewhere between 15 and 25 years old. He stands out like a sore thumb.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I do.
But you had to think. Another example, higher headquarters was of no great assistance in these matters. I'll tell you that.
Well, I want to ask you, would you comment on the whole body count thing and the pressure that you were an opso there, and the pressure that put on you. What happened if you weren't giving them bodies? Was that problematic for you as a leader, as an operations officer?
It depended who you were dealing with.
Okay.
I remember up north with General Davis in the 3rd Marine Division, we got heavily mortared in a landing zone one day. It was a bad day, to say the least. The worst day I had over there.
LZ Margo, you told the story the last time you were on.
Yeah, LZ Margo, and we were attacked by infantry after the mortars. Never so proud of Marines in my life. The ones on the high ground who could see, they could look down, they could see the enemy coming up the hill, the enemies coming up the hill to attack through the landing zone. They ran off the hill. These Marines were running right at them. And there was a collision. And that bunch of North Vietnamese got their ass out of there as fast as they possibly could. And they suffered casualties as they ran away down in the woods. It was a wooded hill. The next day, General Davis came out, and I talked to him. I briefed him on what happened, et cetera. And I talked to him. I'm so proud of those Marines. I said, and then you should have seen when they attacked us, sir, with infantry. The guy's up on that hill there, running down across his landing zone. He said, you had an infantry attack. And I said, yes, sir. He said, I wasn't briefed on that. I didn't know that. And I said, well, we reported it, sir, whatever. But we did. It wasn't a big thing, but whatever. And he said, did you get a body count? And I said, no, sir. They looked at me. I said, sure, I'm not going to send Marines down there to look for dead bodies and get ambushed and get killed themselves. I said, this body count stuff is going too far. Gave a little pat on his shoulder, nodded and said yes, and that was that. So that was one guy. Other places, yeah, they would be on you for a body count, but I'd give them a body count if there was a real body count. And if there wasn't, they didn't get anything. And I didn't really give a damn what they thought.
Certainly officers that were less confident than you, I'm sure that would have taken, I'm sure that would have taken a toll on them, because to me, where some guys, and again, you're atypical, you're at that point in your career, you're a major lieutenant colonel, but you're headed for the rank of 2 stars. You don't get to that area without being a confident, smart, leader. And so it's just kind of interesting when you read about these things like body counts, like VC. I mean, walking through it with you, you know, you make it sound like common sense. I remember hearing General Zinni talk about when he went back to be a company commander, he had had a previous tour as an advisor. He said, so there's an element of confidence that I had. And he said, the first time I saw a scalp that was in the cover of one of my Marines, he said, I grabbed that cover, I threw it in a fire, and I said, if I ever see this shit again, there's going to be trouble. He said, I did the same thing when I saw some pictures. And he said, you know, the look I got was this look of relief, not a look of hatred that I didn't understand. I got this look of relief that this stuff wasn't going to be tolerated anymore. And so it's interesting the way strong leaders handle it. And the response, and the reason I find this discussion so interesting, and I want to bring it back to Milai here in a second and get your thoughts, but, you know, in our song, sir, there's the line, and to keep your honor clean. Did they know? Because one of the interesting things about, you know, watching interviews from Milai, you can watch a series of interviews from, I think it's, the story breaks in 1970, and so then they start looking for guys that fought there, and so they're young guys. You know, if they were there when they were 19, they might be 21 now when the story breaks and they're being interviewed, and they're still very much giving you the party line from Milai. 20 years later, having lived with it every day, they're much different human beings, and you see the toll that it takes on them as people. One guy's attempted suicide 3 times. When his son was killed, you know, by a stray round from a gang shooting, he said when I picked him up, I could see the little boy that I shot in Milai, and I knew God had taken his revenge on me. And, exactly. And so you live with that forever. And so to me, this concept of keep your honor clean, it's not just do the right thing. It's if you don't, you have to live with it, and that is a fate, I'm not going to say worse than death, but it is a incredibly horrible burden to have to bear throughout all of this. And so I want to get your, and again, so, and I say that in light of Paris Island, the leadership failures there. Those guys will live with that forever. They'll never get away from it. The urination stuff in Afghanistan, you know. The lives that got ruined, the guys who went to the brig, the guys who had their careers ended over it, you know, the 3-5 incident in Hamadiya in Iraq, you know, all of this stuff, you don't do it for this concept of honor. Know that underneath that concept is this thing that will echo and through your life and make your life far worse. But I don't know that we understand it that well. Kind of a trite little phrase, keep your honor clean, do the right thing. Hey, we know better. We're going to get even, blah, 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 blah. I'm curious your thoughts on that. There's tangible reasons to keep your honor clean, and I can't believe it's in our song. Maybe they knew it back all the way back then.
Okay. Now, I would tell you, I will recount an incident that I think about frequently. Not that frequently anymore. Our battalion, I didn't know this particular individual. Our battalion had a Marine who went UA from Quezon. And he got to the coast. He did it all on foot. and he weaved his way through the enemy and all that sort of thing, got out of Kaifeng, wound up in the Da Nang area. He had been apprehended a couple of times because every time he got the venereal disease, he went to sick bay someplace to get fixed. And, of course, they turn him in and whatever. So it happened that I was getting ready to go to on R&R, and I came in out of the bush, and they caught this guy again, and they tried the rear echelon, the battalion executive officer in control, tried to get him put in the brig, and the response was that the brig is overcrowded. He is your problem. It is clearly a leadership failure on your part. And we got the leadership failure lecture, and we had to take care of him. So they put him in the, and they made a brig and put him in the brig. And they had an armed guard with orders, if he tries to get out, shoot to kill. And I got back, and I was told about this stuff, and I just said, no, this can't. If he tries to get out, and that guard, that Marine shoots him and kills him, that Marine is going to go home, and sooner or later, as he gets older, if nothing else, he's going to look back on it, and he's going to regret what he did, and it's going to bother him. It's going to make a great impact on his life. Therefore, what will be done is if the man is fed, the Marine is fed, they come back and get his dishes and this, that, and the other, they're going to forget, and they're going to lock, and they're going to forget to lock the door. And in the morning, this cat's going to be gone, and the next time he turns himself in with VD, why, somebody else is going to have to take care of him. But, That thought on that occasion stuck with in my mind, and it happened elsewhere. Watch what they're doing. Just make sure that they're not committing an atrocity. This idea. One day they found a death. We were in South. I think 1st Marine Division area. They radioed to me. They had found that a deaf boy was being used as a message drop for the local VC. What do we do with a deaf kid? And my youngest son was born deaf. And all I could think of was, we got to get that kid the hell out of there. But under no circumstances will anybody do anything to him. And that went back and I had the feeling on the radio they were wondering about this deaf kid. Maybe it might be best that we remove him from the opportunity to become a message bearer. Because that kid didn't know what the hell he was doing.
Right.
We just pass a message. But when pieces of paper.
But when your mind's pissed off because your unit's taking casualties, and you've had the horrible intimate experiences that you had in LZ Margo, right? I mean,
it's
when your mind's poisoned with that hate, then it takes an uncommon leader to keep you disciplined and on the straight and narrow so that you can go back home and live your life and be able to sleep at night.
But, Mac, more so that they... those troops could go back. That's
right. No, exactly. Exactly.
Part of being, it's part of the responsibility of somebody in command. And I was, there'll be people listening and say, well, he was the S3, he wasn't in command. I don't know how to say it. It's not quite true. the battalion commander, LZ Margo broke him, and he's gone now, and I won't tell his name. It broke him, and what I wanted to do in the field with that battalion is what was done. And he went along with it all. I mean, he agreed with everything. He wouldn't even talk to, he'd make himself scarce when a general officer or a colonel came out to talk to us to see what was going on and whatever. I talked to all of them. Which I'm surprised somebody or some of your listeners haven't picked off before. You know, the three talking to, General Davis, the battalion commander was someplace else, unavailable. And so I regarded myself as, in my heart of hearts, I was the commander.
Well, you know, and again, the commander, I mean, he approves the operation, but I mean, the OPSO is down there, you know, throwing gears and working out the application of it as it lays out on the ground. So I, you know, again, like, okay, yeah, he sets it in motion, but who's the guy that makes it go, that makes it happen on the ground? And that is the OPSO. And so, I don't know, the OPSO got his hand normally all over everything. Hey, so we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the issue of race in Vietnam. Get your thoughts on that.
Sure.
I also want to talk about one of the things that you read about as part of My Lai is rape. And it's one of the things that is part of the Vietnam narrative, should I say. And I'm just curious to get your thoughts on it. And again, I heard you say very, very matter-of-factly, you know, it wasn't, you know, a few minutes ago, it wasn't hard. It was the same as it was in World War II or in any conflict. You know, a civilian is a civilian. And so I want to get your thoughts on these things. My guest this morning is retired Marine Corps Major General Jarvis Lynch. We're talking leadership, specifically leadership in Vietnam. Was it different? And we'll continue that discussion right after this on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for All Marine Radio, the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with a serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends, these are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Mike McNamara with you, and privileged again to be joined by retired Marine Corps Major General Jarvis Lynch, living in Tampa, sweating while he's living through the summer, and outside work in the middle of the day, not happening. Am I right or wrong about that?
It's not happening now. It used to happen. I used to figure that if I did that, I was really getting in shape. But White put a stop to it.
I have other friends that live down there, and they said Tampa's a bit of a challenge in the summer, no matter where you've ever been in your Marine Corps life. It certainly is. Both with the twin sisters of heat and humidity make it pretty rough. So. Anyway, first of all, sir, thanks for doing this again. I want you to know that I truly appreciate it and love having you on to talk leadership.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you. I love doing it.
Talk to me about race in the Marine Corps. The nation's a segregated nation, and it's not just a southern thing. There were northern cities, cities Boston fight segregation into the 80s with their busing stuff. And, we were a nation that was just, we were going down this road of, or continued to go down the road of integration. 1968, a tumultuous year. What was it like, what was the Marine Corps like? Were there a lot of race problems? Was it like any other leadership issue you dealt with? You had to take it on head on. Your thoughts?
Well, the first thought that I had about race when I went to Vietnam, the desk editor of the U.S. News and World Report, Saigon, came to us at Con Tien because the word was that we were going to be attacked within a few days by North Vietnamese, Con Tam being up in 3rd Marine Division area, right, up near the DMZ. And the guy came up there, and I was not very receptive. I answered what he asked, but he was there because he said, "You're going to be attacked when it happens. They won't allow news people in, but I want to have seen the ground so I can write about it with some background knowledge." He, by the way, turned out to have been a Korean War Marine who was a rifleman who served in a rifle company of a major for whom I had worked in Hawaii when the major was a captain. But in any event, we got it all sorted out. But he called me after a while. He said, "Is there something wrong with me? What's bothering you?" And I said, "You know, I was in the States. I read all about this. Battalions are overloaded with blacks, with being unfair to blacks. They're being used as cannon fodder." I start reading this crap, and I come out here, and after I've been here a couple of days, it suddenly occurred to me, I haven't seen a black Marine yet. Where are all these blacks that are being used as cannon fodder? Well, the battalion had about same percentage of blacks in the battalion as there were blacks in the overall population, and I'm quite certain the Marine Corps didn't do that on purpose. That had been a real challenge in those days to get that much done. But in any case, it angered me that the media was lying again. I learned a lesson there. I told him why I was upset. And the guy said, "Major, you got to understand, what we write in Vietnam goes through editors in New York and Washington. And many times we don't recognize what we wrote." I said, understood. So in any event, that's background. As far as leadership day to day in the field, I honestly, God, never thought about it. Never gave it a thought. Because there was no way, in my opinion, that race was going to be allowed to enter into what was occurring in the bush. Everybody had to rely on everybody else. This, that, the other, teamwork aspect. Race, we were fairly ignorant of all the problems until I was. I won't say we. I knew eventually it dawned on me that they do have troubles in the rear echelon, but still not so much in the infantry battalion. But race was a problem there in the rear. They started talking about the fragging of officers.
Right.
And what I heard about, I got the impression it was an Army problem. And I didn't know until I got back to headquarters Marine Corps, there'd been some of that in the Marine Corps. I didn't know that. So I realized I sound kind of stupid, but in any event, in the bush, there wasn't, from my opinion, there was no problem. We had black officers. They were accepted. I don't know what else to say. I can tell you a story. After I got transferred from the battalion, I was with the battalion about 9 months, and every day we were in the field, the day in the bush, in the combat situation or potential combat situation, the day started with the S3 announcing that today is a save a grunt day. This is to the company commanders on the radio. It's a save and grunt. John Brown saved, that was our call sign when I started all this. John Brown save a grunt day. The American parent would prefer to buy ammunition, artillery ammunition, rather than try to raise more sons or something like that. But go for supporting arms was the point. And I did it every day, just a lot became something habitual. But I think kept them up on the step on thinking about supporting arms. We did a lot of work on coordinating supporting arms with whatever we were doing. And I was there 9 months of this, and then I got transferred to the Special Landing Force staff as the operations officer. And the Special Landing Force, of course, was the battalion, but I was one step above the battalion now because we had a helicopter squadron that was also under the Special Landing Force staff. And I was on the hangar deck, walking across the hangar deck. I'd been there, you know, 2-3 days. Walking across this hangar deck, and there were a group of Marines that lollygagging around on the hangar deck. And what the hell are those guys doing here? Because one of the things we were very short of was Marine infantry in that battalion anyway. I don't know about everybody else, but we didn't have a whole lot there for a while. And I stopped and said, what are you Marines doing here? Because they obviously had nothing to do. They were all wounded on their way back to their companies. And they had been held up there for physicals again and whatever. And they were all black. And one of them looked at me and said, sir, he said, that's not the question. Ooh. I said, what's the question? He said, we want to know what you're doing here. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, the word is out. He said, nobody taking care of the brothers anymore. No more John Brown, John Brown Save a Grunt Day.
He quoted it.
Yeah, oh, he quoted it. Yeah. Oh, I felt about 3 inches tall.
Wow. Wow.
But anyways, The problem was there. It was mostly in the rear. And I don't know what else to say about it.
No, that's fine. Would you say, I've heard the same thing relative to drugs. But yeah, there were drugs in Vietnam, but in the places where you had to bet your life on each other, do you think Marines would allow guys to walk point high? And then you hear other people say, oh yeah, people got high all the time. But the Marines I've spoken to from Vietnam said, not in my unit. You know, it might have been in Da Nang or someplace, but I'll tell you what, where the rubber met the road, you could go, would you even go out there drunk? Were you crazy?
We encountered it with another battalion in the field near Da Nang, and these Marines were high, and their battalion was told about it. But no, we didn't have that problem in our battalion in the field. Drugs were not an issue, and I tell you why. I tell you who the group best tuned in on this kind of thing was the staff NCOs.
Right.
And they watched the black business like a hawk. That's where I learned about it, was from staff NCOs. And telling me what they did and what they're watching for and all that. And it's not here, sir, don't worry about it. Oh, how about drugs? It's not here, sir, don't worry about it. You don't have to think about that. But the staff NCO. And when you stop and think about it, that's the perfect group to have picked it off in the first place.
Right. No, that's how you design the system.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because we had a sergeant major. The staff engineers were terrified of him. Oh yeah, his first firefight was Guadalcanal when he was 17 years old.
Holy shit!
He was a fraudulent enlistment right from the get go. When he was about 6'3", weighed about 250, shaved his head every morning, and didn't tolerate any nonsense from anybody. Except DS3 now and then.
Talk to me about rape. Rape is one of the things that you see about Vietnam. And it's when you watch interviews about My Lai, it's one of the things they did is they rolled through that village. They raped women, they shot up, and they stood up, and then they shot them.
I have no incident of rape. We did have on one operation. I should say, we moved a great deal, which may have helped somewhat. But we had one operation. It was 1st Marine Division, and it was called Mead River. And we were in one area for a couple of weeks. And the battalion, I don't think it was rape, but the battalion exec called me from the rear and said, Fox Company is sending guys to the rear now. We got 5 or 6 guys now that have venereal disease. They're up to something on that damn. It was a cordon operation, a big cordon around this one area.
Right.
So I had to throttle Fox 6. It was prostitution, not rape. At least I was convinced of that once she talked to me. And I released his throat from my hip. And I was convinced that he was sufficiently motivated to tell me the truth. It was prostitution. It wasn't rape. I never heard of it. And frankly, I don't know how in the world, why in the world, anybody would rape those poor women there, because the most unappealing looking people in the world were those poor people living in those villages. I never heard of it and never encountered it, as far as I know.
You're making the case to me that leadership in Vietnam was no different than the leadership challenges that anybody's ever faced. Yeah, it was different, but you were getting trained to that. Yeah, there were challenges there that were unique to the fight, but they're the same challenges that the Marines and soldiers have faced wherever they've gone on the planet.
I think so. And I was thinking during the break, some of this I learned from my brother, who went to Vietnam before I did. His first full tour in Vietnam was just before mine. And he took over, he went in with the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing. He was an EOD guy, an infantry primary, EOD secondary. And he maneuvered his way very artfully into getting transferred to the 1st Marine Division, where he became a rifle company commander. And when he took the company over, ear collection was a big thing in that company. And with strings of ears. And he told them, you people stink. And I don't like this. This is wrong. Get rid of those ears. I don't want to see it again. And they got rid of the ears. It didn't cause any problem. But he had to watch. They stopped a bus, a Vietnamese bus, not very big, but a bus that was stopped by his company on Route 1 not long after there had been an ambush and where he lost some troops. And every passenger on that bus had a set of Marine dog tags for wearing it. And he thought, boy, all he could think about was getting those people off that bus, getting the dog tags away from them, and getting them on the road. They could hike their way to Da Nang. But his troops were about ready to do him in. If he had let it go, they'd have done him in. There wouldn't have been any passengers for that particular bus after that incident. But you just had to do it. But I'll tell you what really, you want to hear what really frosted me one time?
I do, and I want to go back to My Lai, and I want to get your reaction as the story, you're back in CONUS, and as the story comes back, as the story begins to come out, I want to hear your reaction to it. But yeah, I want to hear what frosted your ass.
in, because you didn't get a whole lot of help sometimes from higher acorns. But what did I think about My Lai? It was what I said it was. Undisciplined rabble. And I just couldn't believe that American troops could do that kind of thing, what I read. And that's all. And I was ashamed. I was filled with shame, but I thank God it wasn't Marines who did it. That may be a very superficial reaction, but that was what it was.
What do you say, again, I've had people tell me, none of them infantrymen, that this stuff went on all the time. That we shot civilians all the time. You know, you see in any movie the door gunners flying over, you know, shooting at people, you know, shooting at water buffalo, you know, and just random violence as they move throughout the country, and they paint this picture of this military that's out of control. What do you say to those people?
Bullshit. Plain and simple. I never saw stuff like that. I think we killed one civilian who did not deserve to die. I think there was one when we were near Da Nang, but other than that, no, we did not shoot civilians. We did not torture prisoners. I put a stop to it when it would get started, which was not started by us. It would be started by somebody from some interrogator, whatever the hell they were.
Right,
the civil
right.
I don't know what they were. Right. They would come out. The prisoners would go to them, and this one guy was interrogating a prisoner, and one of my right hand man was a lance corporal. I won't use his name now, but the corporal, lance corporal, then corporal, outstanding Marine. But he came near me. And he was sweating. This was at night. What are you doing? You've been sweating. What are you doing? Well, I've been cranking the generator, sir. What generator? What are you talking about? Well, the prisoner. He's asking the prisoner questions, and somebody's got to crank the generator. We'll put a stop to that. But they had the guy wired up, testicles wired.
Right. But again, that is the same stuff that goes on in every conflict in units that don't have strong leaders. You know, again, we've seen it. We've seen it at Abu Ghraib with the stupid nonsense that went on there.
Yeah. Oh, that was disgusting.
It's just stupid. I mean, it's not like, you know, the Iraqis had a very interesting things to say about that. They said, you Americans are very funny. You know, it's like, what do you mean? Well, do you know what used to go on there? They didn't used to, you know, make them, you know, pile them on each other and take pictures of them, you know, with a dog or, you know, in the vicinity or something like that. They used to hang them by hooks in the ceiling and drill their kneecaps. They used, when it got overcrowded, they would line them all up and they'd shoot every third guy. That's what used to go on in there. So we know we're watching your nation, you know, having this great debate about what happened in Abu Ghraib. And we laugh because as far as we could tell, it was just a bunch of stupid people doing stupid things. Nothing significant happened there. And you would know that if you knew what he used to do there with electricity, with drills, and with pistol. And so it was very interesting to hear them talk. But again, where there's weak leaders, this stuff seems to blossom, because I think you could say in all combat operations, the ground is fertile, given the amount of hate, given that becomes your life on a daily basis, the taking of life, and it certainly can become very easy if you lose your way. That's when these things happen. I've got an email question. I've got an email question for you. Mac, it was very interesting last week for me to go through your shows. I, like you, hadn't listened to those interviews. I knew about Milai in a general way, but listening to the interviews blew me away, to be honest with you. To think that Americans would rape, stand up and kill a young woman, and then go ahead and shoot little kids is still beyond me. I thought about it even over the weekend. And listening to General Lynch this morning, he, in a very matter-of-fact way, says it's the same leadership that we do all over the place. And if you don't do that, bad things will happen. Now, to think Milai is one of those bad things, I struggle with. I remember hearing the statements of Captain Medina talking about he saw nothing that day. Lieutenant Calley saying that his only crime was that he cared about his soldiers more than he cared about anything else. And I sit there and I scratch my head, how could these guys be leaders in the United States military? Very interesting shows. I have a question for General Lynch. When he learned about the Milai stuff, did he watch it? Did he tune it out? And was there any repercussions or training stand downs in the Marine Corps because of this thing in the news so much? So, first of all, thanks for the email. Sir?
Yeah.
As you watched it, did you pay attention to it? Did you tune it out? And was there any official reaction by the Marine Corps in terms of, you know, now we do a safety stand down or we'd have a day devoted to not doing tailhook stuff or something like that?
First, I paid attention to it in the sense that when it was on a television, I watched, and when it was in the newspaper, I read about it. But and I just had the feelings that I had, and there was nothing I could do about it.
Right.
What happened happened, and I was in the areas of that village, so I had familiarity. It probably hit me harder than it would had I not been familiar somewhat with that geographic area, which was definitely a Viet Cong area, to say the least. The as far as the Marine Corps reaction, I was at headquarters Marine Corps, and I don't recall there was no official reaction that I can recall. And I can just recall guys talking about it, but there wasn't, so far as I can remember, there was no official thing going out in the Marine Corps about this, and this better not happen, or retraining, or anything like that. And quite frankly, I think the story itself was enough training. That should have, any thinking person reading that business, would come to the right conclusion.
It is astounding. I have a question about the Viet Cong for you. Could you explain how the Viet Cong interacted with the NVA? Viet Cong a local presence, right, with linking files to the NVA, who at any time could plug into it and use it and have facilities prepared for their use and then migrate out of the area? How did the Viet Cong and the NVA relate to each other?
First, it was my understanding that many of the South Vietnamese didn't much care for the North Vietnamese. And secondly, I was told that they had trouble communicating because the southern dialect was so much different from the northern dialect. But that much having been possibly rumor, possibly actual, I don't know. I just thought of the Marine Corps, our program. We had a program where we had squads of Marines living in villages.
Right.
It worked just fine. But that's a slightly different subject. No. The Viet Cong, what was left of the Viet Cong by the time I was there, and the North Vietnamese in the Da Nang area or further south, the Americao Division area, they were the Viet Cong, I think, were fundamentally a supporting force. And the best example I can give is this big operation I mentioned, Mead River. Several battalions had a North Vietnamese regiment trapped in an area, in a wooded area. We were the ones, our battalion, 226, the battalion landing team, the infantry portion, although I will point out, we did, when we first went in, we used the truck platoon, the mortar, the four-deuce mortar platoon. We had the area, the reinforcements to the battalion landing team. We used them as infantry when we first went in because our area was larger than what we had could cover with the infantry that we had because we were understrength. Every Marine rifleman was put into action right there when we went into that operation. But in any event, as the cordon closed, we were the ones closest to that wooded area. And we were the ones who knew more about it than anybody else. And what we knew was that there were concrete fortifications in that wooded area.
Uh-oh.
And I couldn't, for the life of me, figure out how the hell concrete fortifications got into a wooded area south of Da Nang. And had everything in my mind. I thought, well, maybe the Japanese did it. Well, why would the Japanese do it when they had control of Indochina? What it turned out to be, at first, one night in the cordon operation, and we did something that was illegal. I know it was illegal. I didn't give a damn. If one of our guys got a prisoner, that guy got R&R, and I don't give a damn whether he was on R&R last week, but he gets another R&R. We want prisoners. And this Marine, one night, he and another Marine were on the court. They had to watch for the in their area, and this Marine said, "Snake, cover me. I'm going to get an R&R. I'm going to get another R&R." And he got up, walked over, boom. He put his foot on the head of a guy crawling out of that, trying to crawl out of that cordon. Well, and they got it, the sun came up the next morning and they got this guy. We never allowed them to talk to prisoners or try to talk to them or anything else. The company commander could make a try at it if he thought he knew enough, but in any event, this guy was older, and he was armed with a pistol. And he made a mistake. The guy tried to palm himself off as a warrant officer or something like that, but he was too old for that. And he developed that he was the G4, the district G4, Viet Cong G4. He was the G4 for the Viet Cong district. And he was a liaison. He's working back and forth with this regimental commander who's trapped inside, and this guy obviously been in there with working with the regimental commander and then crawled out. Long story short, those concrete bunkers had been built by the NVA. Where did they get the cement? USAID program. Okay? The Viet Cong were buying the cement or stealing it off the market. That USAID, the State Department, had set up. And we were about to assault into concrete bunkers that had been provided courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer via the Viet Cong to the NVA. That's what their value was to the NVA, in my opinion.
Wow.
Was getting assets and dealing with local problems for the NVA.
So this
damn regiment in this woods, that was about 300 yards from a big cantonment of ROK Marine, South Korean Marine.
Wow.
Yeah, And if there was one thing that terrified the Vietnamese, it was South Korean Marines, I'll tell you that. But anyway.
The okay, a final question, a final question about My Lai. Is My Lai simply what happens? And again, what astounded me about My Lai and kind of really got me interested in it was I watched something initially about it, and it said that, you know, this company had only been in Vietnam for 7 weeks.
Whoa.
And that dropped my jaw because I thought, no, these guys have been chewed up, they're pissed, and they're bitter, and they're going to go even some scores. And so when I found out they'd had three soldiers killed, 34 wounded, and all of it by either mines or sniper fire, which would have been, and this is on the heels of Tet. So the Viet Cong and the NVA literally they've been bled white. And so in the midst of this, My Lai happens. Is it just one of the things that could happen in any conflict if you have weak leadership?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, Mac. Nothing good can happen if you have weak leadership. Nothing good can happen. Nothing good.
What was My Lai like when you were around it? I think I read that it might have been an investigation. The investigation is very interesting, by the way. I believe I read that they took all the people out of there initially. The village had been obviously burned. What was My Lai like when you were operating there? Because it was part of 3MAF at the time.
But
3MAF, it never even gets to 3MAF visibility because the division, the AmeriCal division, it doesn't get outside the AmeriCal division.
Well, when we were in that area, I don't know where, I never saw the village of My Lai or its ruins, right? When we were in that area, I didn't know a thing about My Lai. It had already occurred, which was interesting to me. But we were there for a couple of weeks, and we never heard a word about this. We never heard anything. My Lai, I was amazed when I looked at the Washington Post and the map they had and where My Lai was. I said, hell, that's where we were. And so we might have been right around it, but I didn't know anything at all about My Lai at the time.
I think by the time you got there, it had already been processed, because one of the interesting things that the AmeriCal division really gets taken to the fence post about is it gets reported, you know, up the battalion chain of command as 20 to 24 civilians that got caught in the artillery prep of the LZ and probably some crossfire between soldiers of Charlie Company and VC. And so that was the official report. You had the helicopter, the Kiowa, the small helicopter, that guy who lands his helicopter, and saves about a dozen people. He goes back, he calls in a gunship, a Huey gunship, and they evacuate 12 people in the Huey gunship, and they go back and they say, hey, something really bad happened in that city, that village. And so it's outside the battalion at that point, and it comes to the division. The chief of staff takes a look at it, and then he says, yeah, I went down, I talked to Charlie Company, gets a group of 30 to 40 soldiers. Anybody see any? Now, they're out of My Lai. They don't go, the chief of staff doesn't go to My Lai. He goes to find Charlie Company. Anybody see anything bad? No, sir, we didn't. That was the extent. 2-page investigation done. Doesn't even get in written format until through the advisor chain comes this report from village elders, I guess, through the advisors that between 400 and 500 civilians were killed in My Lai 4. And now that's outside. That's a completely separate chain. And it lands at the AmeriCal, but they still, it doesn't go any further than that. They said, yeah, we've already done that. He had the chief, the division commander has the chief of staff put the report now in writing, and it's papered. So by the time you had been there, they had already digested it a year later.
Yeah.
So interesting. All right. So well, first of all, again, always a pleasure to talk.
Yeah, but Mac, you didn't let me tell you my big gripe.
Oh, go ahead.
Can I do that?
Absolutely.
Is it all right?
No, absolutely. Go ahead.
It's the kind of thing that annoys you. We land. We're unfamiliar with the area south of Da Nang. We land. We don't know. We know where we are. We don't understand what's happening. This and the other. Boobie boo. But we are protecting a leprosarium. See? This is south of Da Nang.
Okay. Tell everybody what that is.
It's a place where lepers live, because they had leprosy over there, and this was a place for lepers. And it was very well, it was almost like a holy site to three mass and everybody else. And part of our task was to protect the leprosarium. We were to search out a village that no longer existed, and that part, I never did understand what the hell we were doing there. But in any case, we had landed from the ships. The ships were still offshore, and we were still under their operational control. And I got a radio message one day, said, a few days after we landed, a doctor, a Navy lieutenant, doctor, medical doctor aboard one of the ships, his hobby is leprosy, and he has heard that there's a leprosarium, and he's really begging us to let him come ashore, somebody take him to the leprosarium, because he wants to see the prisoners and all that, or the patients, rather. So I said, sure, it's fine. So he flew in. We gave him a squad. Squad took him to the leprosarium, and he comes back, and he says, sir, he says, those aren't lepers. They don't have leprosy. I said, what are you talking about? He said, they have cards saying they're lepers. These are all young men. He said, they're in their 20s. I've forgotten how many of them there were now, but it was about a platoon. And he said, you shake hands with a leper. He said, if you squeeze his hand, he can't squeeze back. He has no strength in his hand. They're losing strength and all that. Those guys are very healthy young men. I'd watch them very closely. And I said, I thank you very much for your advice. Flew him back out to the ship, and I reported it up through chain of command to the regiment. I said, these guys aren't lepers. And I had a doctor expert on it telling me to watch them, because they're bad business. You know what we got for a reaction?
What?
They're lepers. Don't worry about it. They're lepers. And nobody did a damn thing. And we took some casualties out of that leprosy. And I didn't like it very much. It was not necessary.
Did you ever go there?
Did I personally go to the leprosy? No, I went to the village around it, but not to the leprosy. I don't want to say it. But, no, they were off limits. And I was very glad when we left there, that whole area. Their biggest problem, the thing that was causing them the problem, was the village next door to the cantonment. That's where the problems were coming from, and they wouldn't believe it. But that's because they were friends with the people's, the civil affairs and all that kind of stuff. I see, the problem is that village right there. That's the same village that resisted our landing and caused us some problems.
Right.
But I'm taking your time now.
No. I have one email question.
Yep.
Mac, if General Lynch could offer us one reason why we failed in Vietnam, what would that be? So I'm sure you could lecture for hours on the subject. One reason, why did we lose in Vietnam?
Political. Politics. Too much Washington. And which caused a counter reaction from the media and from the American public. Yeah, we didn't lose Vietnam in Vietnam. We lost it in Washington and the rest of the United States.
All right, sir. Okay. What is, no, I, that is the consistent refrain from guys who fought in Vietnam. We didn't. We certainly didn't lose it in Vietnam. What? Interesting stuff. First of all, thank you for doing this very much. I appreciate it as always. And
thank you.
I have to tell you, your brother Chuck is an interesting guy.
He is.
Very much as an aside, he threw out the fact that he had done over 100 Keiko calls when I interviewed him, and I just stopped. I said, "What did you just say?"
Yeah.
He said, "Yeah."
That's why he went back to Vietnam.
Yeah, and he tells the story of he said I couldn't do anymore. I said I know guys who are brave guys who run from doing one. He said, "Well, yeah, I couldn't run. There was nowhere to run. I was a recruiter, and one of your collateral duties was to be a Keiko." And I said, "A 100?" He said, "Yeah, it was." Yeah. He said, "It was horrible." He said, "In fact, I called my monitor early and said you got to get me out of here." And he said, "The only openings I have are in Vietnam." And he said, "I'll go."
Yeah, yeah, and it's all true. And I knew that at the time. And you fast forward to Iraq, the first Iraq. I was at Parris Island. I had Parris Island then, but also the Eastern Recruiting Region. And I was told that in the event there are casualties, the recruiting commanding officers will be the casualty assistance officers or whatever it was called. And I said, not in the Eastern Recruiting Region. You do not bury those whom you have recruited and be able to continue to recruit. So the recruiters will have nothing to do with it. I had a fight with the headquarters Marine Corps until finally somebody said, you know, he's got a point. So they gave it to the INIs, which I felt sorry for them, the inspectors.
Right.
But, yeah, no, they were going to do it to say, well, they did it in Vietnam. I said, that's right, they did it in Vietnam. You want to hear some stories, talk to the recruiter. Yeah. He went to one casualty assistance call. The Marine who was killed, his family was mafiosa. And they were not happy with the Marine Corps. And my brother was saved by a nun who came running into that home, got right in the middle of the dispute because the nun knew they were mafiosa and she knew what they were thinking about. And what they were thinking about was getting a little revenge on the Marine Corps. So it wasn't all, it was terrible. Anyway, Mac, I enjoyed talking to you, my friend. I wish you the best of luck. Okay.
All right, sir. Have a good day. Good luck with that heat.
Yeah. Okay, Tiger. You take care.
All right, bud. That is retired Marine Corps Major General Jarvis Lynch. You know, we've been we've been raised that Vietnam was so different. Might Vietnam be the same? Have unique challenges like every conflict we've ever fought, from social to you know, the kind of war it is. Good leaders adjust, bad leaders flounder. Interesting. More of All Marine Radio. Gunner's going to join me next here on a Monday. Coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.